I'm going to start off actually just by giving some, trying to tease out some of the key themes which came about from the International Counterparts Conference on Climate Change. Just a little bit of, it's kind of hard to distill the key themes on something which was a two-day conference, and it's on very broad topics of the science, the economics and the policy implications of climate change, but I'll do my best this morning to try to tease out some of those things. Just to give you a little bit of perspective first off, the conference itself was a gathering of international counterparts, we call them, organisations like CEDA from around the world. We had nine countries represented from many European countries, Asia Pacific, and also the United States. And we also had a number of scientific, business and public policy figures from Australia and overseas take part in the conference. Let me just sort of firstly deal with some of the subjects. And the first one really is the science. And Graham's going to talk about that, so I won't really spend a lot of time trying to cover the scientific issues. I'll leave that to the expert. But in summary, I think it was very clear from the conference that there was a clear view that the issue itself needs to be addressed. There was, in fact, we had two scientific experts there, Dr. Pearman, as well as Professor Ronald Prin from MIT. And it was interesting for me that they both agreed very much on, I think, the essential elements of the scientific debate. And even more interesting because Ronald Prin, who's a very well-known figure as well, comes out of MIT, described himself as someone who 8 to 10 years ago wasn't totally convinced about the direct linkage between human activities and climate change. And he said that he's seen the scientific body of knowledge evolve over the past 10 years to the point where he thinks that there is it is an issue certainly that we need to start doing something about. There was an acknowledgement of uncertainty. After all, the forecasts of climate change are made on the basis of computer modelling of what's going to happen in the future. And there's two issues with that. Firstly, how well do we, in those computer models, able to represent the real climate system, the physical aspects of the climate system? And the second issue is we have to make assumptions about what's going to happen with global patterns of energy usage out 100 years or more. Both of those things are obviously inherently uncertain exercises. But I think, as Graham said in summing that discussion up, the issue is that this is one where we can never be totally certain, and the emphasis really from the conference was on the scientific evidence supporting a call for action. So really the key focus areas from the conference were really more about, well, what do we do in the face of this? And that involved considerations of three things. Firstly, economics. Secondly, the state of technologies, various technologies. And the third thing was the state of what I'll call political economy. There's certainly agreement about the complexity of the issue, that the time and the geographic scales are very long, that it requires a strategy that has to reach 100 years or more into the future. There's also was very much agreement that we need to develop and deploy low emission technologies globally in order to limit the growth of greenhouse gas emissions, but also the realisation that is actually going to require an enormous shift in energy production to low carbon emitting technologies. And that's not easy, and that's going to take some time. But it's really the other fundamental issue is how we actually do that, how we achieve that transition, while at the same time safeguarding economic welfare and promoting economic growth, a particularly important aspect of what needs to happen in developing countries. That's the nub of the issue. And it's when you start to get to consideration of that issue that that sort of consensus starts to fracture around questions like what measures do we invoke, how quickly do we move, how much do we need to reduce emissions by, and also what are the costs and benefits of doing so. And I just wanted to share with you a couple of charts from the International Energy Association which show the enormity of the task. This first chart here plots the world energy primary demand by fuel out to 2030. And there's a couple of things to note here. Firstly, you see there, I mean, the number mightn't mean much to you, but I mean, It's the huge scale of energy which is needed to drive the global economy. That's 12,000 million tonnes of oil equivalent a day in 2005-2007. Looked at another way, that's around about 200 million barrels a day of oil equivalent. That's a huge amount of energy. And the second thing is that you'll notice from the chart is that that's a dynamic picture as well. That's growing, goes up to around about the equivalent of 18,000 or about 300 million barrels a day of oil energy equivalent. So the big challenge is for low emission technologies, which you can see represented on the chart there, in the blue and the yellow and the green, for those to take an increasing portion of what is a growing picture. And the figures from the chart are that, you know, essentially the world needs something like 50% more energy than we do today. China and India are going to account for about 45% of that growth in energy demand. And whichever way you look at it, under this scenario, reference scenario, fossil fuels are dominating the energy mix. The International Energy Association has an alternative policy scenario, which I don't have time to go into. But even under that, which has got some fairly aggressive assumptions on, based on the collection of all of the different policy initiatives around the world, you still see greenhouse gas emissions rising by around about 30% as opposed to the 50%. So what does that mean, therefore, for CO2 emissions? That chart here plots the CO2 emissions out to 2030, and just couple of comments on that. We see the growth in emissions if you do add those different lines up there. It adds up to around about 37 billion tonnes of CO2 emissions in 2030, rising from around about 25 today. The second thing to note is that the steepest rise in the emissions is coming from China and those non-OECD countries there, which are represented, China in the red line and the non-OECD countries there. So you can see that whatever we need to do in this area has to be a global approach. Okay, so what do we do? The first theme which emerged from the conference was all around the economics and the need to develop a carbon price signal that starts modestly and rises predictably through time, and also that prices all sources of carbon in an equivalent way. That gives the incentive for investments in research and development of low emissions technologies. It also provides a least cost outcome compared to things like subsidies, mandates, and regulations that prematurely choose winning and losing technologies. Now, there's three different mechanisms that were covered in the conference. I don't really have a lot of time to go into them, but essentially they were emissions trading, which you've probably heard a lot about, a carbon tax, and also a hybrid model, which was covered in an overview sense by one of the economists at the conference, Warwick McKibben. But the main issue that I think emerged from the conference was the need for a price signal and the role that the government would have in establishing the rules and the regulatory regime which would apply, and then allowing the market to decide which of those are the best technologies which would move into the mix. Next issue was technologies themselves, and there was very much an acknowledgement that the change which is needed in this regard is much bigger than just the mere spread of best practices technology. That's important, particularly if we're able to export best practices technologies from industrialised nations to developing countries, but it's not going to take you all the way. It needs, as one of the economists, Brian Fisher, said, an unprecedented development of low emissions technologies through public expenditure to complement private sector initiatives, but also, importantly, to make sure that when you send the price signal out there, that you've got technologies ready to come off the shelf to reduce those emissions. Which ones? Lots of discussion about which ones, and again, I think we can have maybe some questions in the question and answer session. We might cover some of these things, but essentially the answer was all of them. Carbon capture and storage, renewables, hydrogen energy from clean coal, and even nuclear needs to be looked at on a global basis. Then the final issue I'll come to is that of what I've described as the political economy. And a lot of debate about the current approach which we're taking, a targets and timetables approach to a global green agreement-making process. And the question of really how successful has that been and how successful can it be out into the future? The problem that was observed is the uncertainty of the costs associated with reducing greenhouse gas emissions means that you get a lot of targets being set, but backsliding coming when you actually approach the targets because the costs become higher. Or alternatively, you have a lot of what was described as political target setting, unrealistic targets which really aren't able to be met. They're more in the nature of feel-good targets. So the question of what happens next in the international agreement-making process was obviously a very hot topic through the conference. And, of course, a diverse array of views on that, but I think very much a recognition that because of the diverse array of national interests which are at stake in those international negotiations, it's going to be very hard to accommodate all of those different interests, including developing countries and industrialised nations, in whatever agreement gets put together. And probably more of a feeling that we're going to advance down the path of negotiation of bilateral or even in some cases some smaller multilateral agreements, more premised around technology transfer in order to make sure that we do get those low emission technologies coming into the mix, than the prospects of a rapid and in the near term negotiation of a global multilateral agreement. In fact, it was one of the economists, again, Brian Fisher, who said that he felt, and I suppose you don't call economists part of the dismal science for nothing, he thought that it was about 20 years off before we'd actually have a global consensus around this. And what we might have is more likely to be a series of national agreements which get ultimately knitted together into some kind of a multilateral framework. So I guess the other issue which was covered at the conference, and I'll conclude my comments here, was the question of, well, can it be done? And there was a lot of discussion in the scientific debate, and I'm sure Graham will pick up this theme later on, around which should be the target that we're trying to shoot at here. Should it be a 450 parts per million? Should it be 550 parts per million greenhouse gas concentration level? Or the issue which has been raised, at least in our research paper, and was not touched on in the conference, but certainly has been touched on in the research paper, is whether we really should be looking at even a higher target and not closing our minds to the fact that there needs to be a cost and benefit evaluation of looking at a stabilisation of, say, a higher target of 650 parts per million and compare the costs and benefits of that, the costs of achieving it, as against the environmental damage which comes from doing that, and make a rational discussion on that basis. There's a number of international economists now which are really looking at this this proposition in this way. One of them, William Nordhaus, who's very much a world leader in economic thinking on climate change. His view was that raising the target to 650 parts per million would reduce the present cost of abatement by about half, but at the same time, it wouldn't increase the present value of climate change by a very, very significant amount. Now, that's obviously a question on which a lot of people will disagree, and Graham, I'm sure, will have some comments about that. But what I'm trying to do is give you the flavour of where this debate is moving internationally as we look at the real practical issues associated with being able to stabilise greenhouse gas emission concentrations. So finally, I suppose in terms of the key points, I would say what came out of it, well, I think a realisation that there's an enormous task of transformation ahead of us if we're able to achieve this, and we shouldn't underestimate the enormity of that task. The second thing is that you do need a combination of a price signal plus investments in technologies ready to come off the shelf to be able to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, while at the same time be able to supply that basic need for energy that we have to drive the world economy. And the third thing is that we need to also recognise that some of the projections that have been done around economic costs associated with transition underestimate the costs associated with achieving that transition successfully. As again Brian Fisher put it, they imply perfect application all around the world of all of the assumptions following through, when in reality we know that there won't be a perfect application of some of these policy measures. That sounds like a pretty downbeat note to end on, but I suppose the other thing I should say is that it's probably what we do and how people felt about it, I suppose, was best probably summed up by one of the international delegates who said that, you know, hearing all of this in the conference, we probably can feel a little bit pessimistic in the short term, but a lot more optimistic over the long term because of some of the things that we heard, which I haven't actually had a chance to go through, in the nature of some of the technological applications which are coming, some of the exciting developments which may well be with us in the mid-century around solar, and also, you know, a fairly also bullish assessment of the prospects of carbon capture and storage being able to make a difference really in that sort of period, probably beyond 2030. But short term, difficult, longer term, there was at least some optimism that there is a path forward to be able to reduce greenhouse gas emissions substantially.